network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowan Acra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. We have a busy morning show for you today. We'll hear about the Columbia County Fair, which begins tomorrow, from Devin Connolly at the Cornell Cooperative Extension for Columbia and Greene County's Communications Manager. And we'll hear from Jonah Boker and others about Hudson Eye, the multi-venue festival, which continues in Hudson through September 4th. WGXC's Mayuko Fujino speaks with Eric Losh, a Hudson-based freelance illustrator and art director. Plus, stay tuned for the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You're listening to WGXC
Acra,
Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM. We're here for you.
Hello, WGXC listeners. This is Matthew Vinny Harrington, Camp Hill, Hudson, Community Dinner Return. Come one, come all. Community Dinner is back at Camp Hill, Hudson, on Tuesday, September 5th at 5:30 p.m. in evening time at our Solaris building at 360 Warren Street, Hudson, New York. Come experience community meal, new people and old friends over a fresh prepared meal with lovely vegetables meal by local volunteers. We'd be glad to see you there, and please bring a friend.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the McPees of East Hampton, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe with the WGXC Daily News for Tuesday, August 29th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that Greene County Public Health alerted the public August 28th about several reports of suspicious vans targeting predominantly women walking in the Catskill and Jefferson Heights area. Quote, "We understand that law enforcement has been informed and are currently working on this situation," unquote. Greene County public health officials posted on social media also saying, quote, "Please be vigilant while outside, walk with a buddy, share your location, and do whatever you need to do, be feel safe," unquote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Raymond Pignone reports for Columbia Green Media that the Columbia County Department of Health is now monitoring wastewater traces SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, as the new BA286 strain has emerged. No cases of the strain have been found yet in New York, but they have in Michigan and Virginia. Columbia County Public Health Director Victoria McGann said, quote, "This mutation is so new, it doesn't have an official nickname like the Omicron variant. We're keeping an eye on this mutation at the moment. We have wastewater access only in Hudson, and it doesn't represent the rural parts of the county. But that gives us a little idea of what the virus is up to. It's still just a tool, and it doesn't give us the whole picture of what's going on," unquote. McGann says inmates and nursing home residents at high risk for the virus should now wear masks. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Joshua Solomon reports for the Times Union that on August 27th, the Biden administration pushed back after Governor Kathy Hochul's public plea for the federal government to quicken the pace for work authorizations for migrants. Instead, White House officials blamed the Republicans in Congress and New York City's handling of the migrant surge. Hochul held a major press event about needing Biden to let migrants work sooner when they arrive in New York. Hochul said on August 24th, quote, "Our quest continues to squarely tell the White House, quote, let them work," unquote. Current federal regulations do not immediately allow migrants who have applied for asylum to begin working. Read more about this story in the Times Union, and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, August 29th. Local early morning temperatures range from 58 degrees in Tannersville to 65 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 68 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be high, ragweed and grasses being the remaining aggressors. As we wind out the hot end of summer, those will start to die down finally. UV alerts are up for Columbia and Greene counties, even though the skies are expected to be cloudy. A high of 79 happens at 4 p.m. Shortly afterward, chances for a few raindrops show up. Overnight, rain gets stronger and brings in some thunder, and we will see a muggy feeling low of 67. Tomorrow morning continues the rain, actually kicking it up a bit, dropping about a half an inch. That all comes to an end by 2 p.m., then we see a high temperature of 78. Overnight dips to a dry and cool 58 degrees. Thursday will be sunny with a high of 74. And just a quick peek at the upcoming holiday weekend, things look pretty nice. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 1:42 a.m., low tide at 8:38 a.m., high tide again at 2:17 p.m., then low tide once again at 8:46 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 73 degrees again. So far, it's holding pretty steady, but if annual trends are to be held over the next 2 weeks or so, it is going to start its downward trend that doesn't stop until winter. Today's tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 7:23 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:14 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be slow at 355 kilometers per second with a thin density of 4 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair below 60 megahertz overnight. There are no chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 68, and this has been the better weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
You have the already global networks. So my argument is very simple. The present media is too large and wasteful. From now on, we should think about the more smaller media to diverse our culture and community. I have different idea on airwave. Airwave belong to the every people. Everybody, not to the states or a government. Okay, I will make the transmitter now.
That was Go Higher from Hudson Valley's Shana Falana on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Hello, this is Henna. This message is for the Brujas Bilinguist. I want to dedicate a song of their choosing to my future wife, Rachel Freed, and to thank everyone who made our upcoming wedding possible, including our very own Brujas Peli Rojas, Ariel, E, Gloria, for allowing Ariel to spend the weekend, take some time off from recording in order to spend time at our fiesta. Gracias, mazel tov.
Okay, we're on. Yep, Kieran here with you. We got Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. Yeah, I mean, some people refer to it as the Chatham Fair because it's in Chatham, and my buddy and I, who unfortunately passed away, he's a great musician, and we wrote a really cheeky song called No Chatham Fair. So maybe that was about it. But so let's tell us the dates again. This is an amazing event. It goes back, maybe you know how far, but a long, long time ago. And Columbia County Fair has been there for a while. And what are the dates again for that fair coming up? 8:30 through Monday, Labor Day, which is going into September, folks. It's coming on September. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And from there, you can always find the 4-H Milk Bar, selling great milkshakes made by the volunteers or the 4-Hers every day. We'll have a Taste New York sample bar. That's all the products from the Taste New York store at the Capital Region Welcome Center, which promotes agricultural products from the Capital Region. And we also have this really cool new thing this year called the Sensory Room. It's right next to the milk bar. It's for folks who are, you know, neurodivergent and need some time, like a place to be just a little quieter, or like, you know, what's the correct language? Not as like stimulating. And we've set that place up to, you know, so folks, you know, who do need that sort of environment have a place to go during the fair. And that'll be open.
I might be one of those people. Can you actually tell me again what the environment, what the room is and what it's called again?
Yeah, it's a sensory room. And again, it's for folks with, you know, autism or neurodivergent. And the idea of like that you need, like, it's a quieter room. There's no loud noises, no really crazy lights, you know, and it's especially made for, you know, kids in mind and those who, like, you know, it has some games and things that are that I think are last year, we know, you know, just had like even having like the big bucket of Legos, just a place to go and play and sort of like take your minds from like everything else that's happening at the fair. And we're hoping that it'll be, you know, a place for those people to feel safe. And, you know, for parents to be like, oh, yeah, okay, this is, like, you know, easy, easy peasy. Anyone is welcome to go there, of course. I think there is, like, you know, a lot of kids who are just like, I love to be just in this room and, like, not as disruptive around the fair.
That sounds fantastic. That's really a great service. And it goes in line with a lot of what you folks do with agriculture and stuff. I've heard and experienced directly wonderful stories of agricultural activities, particularly work with the mellow energy of bovines, and just cows have an amazing effect on people, especially people who, I guess, like you say, neurodivergent. I've heard stories of people who've kids who've had severe difficulties paying attention, acting out, being hyperactive or whatever, when they get around a cow and actually are asked to participate and help care or even milk the cow by hand, miracles happen. So it's great that you guys in the agricultural sphere are providing this room at the fair for folks. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's also all the, you know, talking about agriculture, there'll be so many 4-H events going on. You know, on Wednesday, August 30th, there's the rabbit show. That'll be in the, and all these are happening in the show ring, which is like, you know, probably closer to the town, Main Street part of the fair. On Thursday, August 1st, is a poultry show, open beef shows. We'll have a mini barnyard in front of our building at Columbia Hall. Swine shows to finish off that day. Friday, there'll be the goats. There'll be a dairy cattle show with heifers and yearlings. Public presentations at Columbia Hall. Saturday, September 2nd, public presentations again, more dairy cow judgings, sheep show, Sunday, September 3rd, the dairy quiz bull exhibition, and of course, another mini barnyard. And then on course Monday, we'll have the livestock sale, which sort of highlights the end of the weekend for 4-H'ers. And, you know, it's a time where you can go and, like, you know, support, you know, youth going into agriculture.
Fantastic. I can't promote enough the importance of local agriculture as a part of our culture. You know, these fairs were the lifeblood, the yearly event of the lifeblood of like a huge sector of our Columbia County and Greene County and upstate county communities, and how we survived, how people lived, how, you know, life was back then. Agriculture was it, and now it's sort of a periphery kind of thing. Well, it's coming back. It's making a comeback thanks to you folks over there at Cornell and the Columbia County Fair keeping on going strong. It sounds like they're doing a great job still, Devin, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely wonderful. Thank you for like the fair board for always putting this together. I think they're doing a fantastic job, and yeah, don't stop.
Okay.
All right. If you want to keep going, so next we actually have on Friday, September 8th, starting at 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. is a class called Invasive Forest Pest. At this class, you can hear from local experts on current pest pressure and learn about new threats to our woods. Participants will learn how to identify these pests, and management options will be discussed during a woods walk. If you're working on your trained logger courses, this actually counts as one TLC CE credit as well. If you want to register for this, you can always look on our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/events. And, of course, you know, you'll see everything that we have coming up on there as well.
Hey, this is important to know with folks like myself who, it's hard to say own. I don't believe in land ownership so much necessarily, but I am the proud owner of 41 acres of forest and would just really am dying to learn stuff about the forest that I don't know, such as these invasive forest pests. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know like the ash borer beetle and whatnot, but I don't know really anything about it. So I would certainly go to that September 8th, that's a Friday, you said, event, that informational event. That sounds great.
Yeah. You can make it. Please come. And it's not just for people who own woods, but anyone who's just, you know, wants to learn more or, you know, ideally want to, even if they don't own, to like manage woods one day, you know, or if you want to be like, all right, I'm going to help Kieran out with his 41 acres. Let's see what we can do.
We're going to have work parties, Devin, so I'll let you know, too. It's going to be fun.
Oh, it sounds fun. I'll be there. All right. Next, we have a couple of classes that, again, I think just mentioned the trained logger certification. This is the first class we'll have is Game of Logging Level 1. This is, you know, this is for actual loggers. It's not quite open to the public. And it does fill up with, like, loggers who we want to be prioritized for these classes. So, if you're a logger working in the Catskills, this event is for you. Game of Logging Level 1 introduces open-face felling and development of techniques to safely use it. Topics include using personal protective equipment, chainsaw safety features, chainsaw reactive forces, bore cutting, pre-planning the fell, and understanding hinge wood strength. This class will take place in the Catskill region. Exact location to be determined.
Sounds good.
Yep. And to also playing with that is another trained logger certification course called Forest Ecology and Silviculture. This training is on Friday, September 22nd, 8 a.m. to 5. So long day. But this training covers wildlife habitat, timber harvest planning, soil and water quality protection, and other topics.
Super important. And another comment just about like the conscientious and responsible, you know, logging and forest management, especially like when we talk about climate change, we talk about changing our environment, just to be aware that trees are so vital and important for our local ecosystems and environment, you know, just the whole cycle. And so to actually get educated about it, which is, you know, not always a part of our past and the clear cutting mentality of the past. So that's great. You're doing that as well.
Yeah. No, we want to keep the trained, you know, the loggers working in this area, you know, as informed as possible on what decisions, what effect they will have, you know, for, you know, their bottom, for, we want to make sure they're making like, you know, that they're making their bottom line with the good decisions and also having a woods that will eventually be able to like regrowth. And then that'll be another opportunity for them as well. As what, you know, and also trying to keep the woods as healthy as possible too. One more class is a continuation of our outdoor mushroom cultivation series. We've had part one and part two already. The next one will be on September 28th, 4:30 to 7. So this is the part three, plan, process, and profit from forest fungi. If you're ready to step up your mushroom cultivation skills and turn that knowledge into a business, you can join us at the Agroforestry Resource Center in Accra to learn what it takes. During this class, participants will hear case studies from other growers who have found success and will receive shiitake business planning resources with detailed guidance on how to apply that knowledge to your farm or to your land. Many different revenue streams associated with mushroom cultivation will be discussed, with a hands-on opportunity to make your own added value product to take home. So, again, this is more advanced. You've taken your mushroom inoculation class and you might be like, oh wow, I really like this, I really like doing this, you know, could I make this, turn this from a hobby into a business plan? And if you are curious about that, this is like, you know, the essential class for you.
Sweet, mycelium rising, here we go. It's not actually the most overwhelming and difficult and complicated thing to cultivate, things like shiitakes and some oak logs in your backyard if you have some shade. I personally have actually never done it, but my neighbors have, and I've helped friends do it, and it's just, I don't know why I haven't. Well, I got so much going on. But like, right, Devin, it's like, it's not something that, only a few can do, right?
No. I mean, you have to be able, you know, fell a tree, or, you know, fell a couple of thin trees, then, you know, be able to cut them up, be able to take a angle grinder with a special bit, be able to drill into the tree, or into the bolt, as they call it, and then you inoculate it, which is basically taking this, like, big syringe-looking thing, putting the mycelium with like the sawdust in there. And yeah, I think we've had people from all backgrounds and of all ages, you know, complete this class. If you're doing it for like a business, you'll probably have a few days of like pretty, you know, okay lifting, and then, you know, they just sit there, you know, and they grow for a year. They don't really need any work until the next year, when you're just like, all right, maybe I'll cut a few more inoculated bolts, and then I think you have to flush the logs with water, basically, and they fruit, and you pick them.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah.
Mushroom pizza on the menu.
Depending on, like, you know, how big an operation, it's like, oh, wow, that took, like, a week 1 year to get ready, and then a week the next year to, like, you know, get them all in the water. Not even. Yeah.
So great. Healthy eating right there.
Mm-hmm. Delicious eating too.
I love it. I love mushrooms.
Well, then the only final thing that we have is sort of actually more of a ways away, but I just wanted to make a shout out. We'll be having a fundraiser called Taste of Twin Counties fundraiser. As for Cornell Cooperative Extension in Columbia and Greene Counties, you know, the board and staff invite you to come hang out with us on Wednesday, November 8th from 5:30 to 7:30, where we'll be enjoying a Taste New York inspired charcuterie table, local dessert, and a silent auction. It's just an event, you know, hopefully, you know, try to raise some funds for the General Religious Association. We would love to see anyone there who can join. And even if you're just, like, curious about the work we do, there'll be staff, there'll be board members. And, yeah, tickets are available on our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/events. Again, if you have any question about our events, you can always call us, email us. Email is ccecolumbiagreen. Hold on a second. What is our email? It's columbiagreen@cornell.edu. And yeah, a lot more information on our website as well.
Right. The work continues. I mean, you guys going, you're over 100 years now of providing farmers, local folks with information and research. You know, farmers who are doing the work, they do their own research by doing the work, and they find out, you know, a crop didn't do well in that soil, and it's probably because that happened last year or whatever. But they don't have the time to actually do the real experimentation and the research that folks like at Cornell Cooperative Extension do.
Mm-hmm.
And so this amazing organization is there as a resource for farmers in, you know, all over the country. It's not just here in New York. Like, this is an accessible, you're so accessible. You can just go there. You can, I remember I needed to do soil samples. Why the heck did I have to? It was like,
could have been a garden, could have been farming. Yeah.
Specific. It was for the town. Mm. The town, they were coming down. They're like, oh, well, we want soil samples to know whether or not you can have animals there on that property, blah, 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 blah. Even though for hundreds of years there have been animals and agriculture. It was just a very persnickety town, which maybe shall remain nameless right now. But I remember picking up the phone and calling you guys and like getting a soil sample kit and like being walked through how you do it. You get random sampling, you got to do this, blah, blah, blah. Turns out I did it totally wrong because I was rushing, but you know, like it's really helpful and accessible and gets you through all sorts of binds that you might find yourself in, and or just if you're curious, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so we love talking to people. Please ask us as many questions as you can. You know, each staff member, I think, whenever I talk to them, just, you know, it's just a plethora of knowledge. And yeah, that's it's wonderful talking to someone who's like an expert in their field. I learn something new like every time.
Farmer who's outstanding in his field. You got to love that. So keep up the great work. And I, for one, am super excited about the Columbia County Fair that would be coming up this week, actually, as a matter of fact, folk. That is August 30th all the way through Monday, Labor Day, September 4th.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are all under siege. We are all diminished by white supremacist hate and violence. It is a scourge on this country. It is a threat to our democracy.
Janae Nelson, president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, calls white nationalism a big security threat to the United States. She was among various civil rights leaders who met with the president and vice president Monday, days after a racially motivated shooting left three black people dead in Florida. Nelson called on people to vote, organize, and protest as the nation finds itself at an inflection point. Some Democrats in the Sunshine State are blaming 2024 presidential hopeful and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for creating an environment and passing policies that foster hate and discrimination. Over the weekend, DeSantis attended a vigil to honor the victims of this past weekend's shooting and was booed by people in attendance. GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy is receiving heat for comparing Democratic Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley to a modern grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan for comments she made in 2019, saying, "We don't need any more black faces that don't want to be a black voice." Ramaswamy stood by his words during a Sunday appearance on CNN.
"I think it is the same spirit to say that I can look at you and based on just your skin color, that I know something about the content of your character."
Former President Donald Trump saw a slight decrease in his support after he skipped the first GOP debate last week, according to a new poll from Emerson College. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley saw the largest post-debate bump, going from 2% to 7%. A new report examines past efforts to combat election disinformation during the 2022 election and previews 2024. The report by the Common Cause found election disinformation will intensify and calls it obligatory for nearly all Republican primary candidates and opportunists seeking financial benefit. Former Stop Disinformation field manager with Common Cause, Roselang Masso, says communities of color are the most common targets of disinformation.
We also know that misinformation and disinformation shops, right, these suppliers really do target folks of color, particularly Latinx folks who are Spanish speakers and Black Americans.
Ranked choice voting is gaining momentum. Close to 50 cities in the states of Maine and Alaska now use the system, which allows voters to rank candidates in order of preference. Ranked choice Boston executive director Ed Shoemaker calls it good for democracy.
Now you don't have to vote with your head, right? You can vote with your heart in a way that really expresses how you feel and what type of leader you want to reflect and lead your community.
Some state political parties are rejecting the system, calling it too confusing for voters. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. An unusual New Mexico redistricting case reaches a state district court next month. Unusual in that it's Republicans claiming that Democrats did the partisan gerrymandering, but also that it will be one of the first cases to employ a partisan gerrymandering test suggested by U.S. Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. In 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court majority ruled in Common Cause versus Rucho that partisan gerrymandering was a political matter and ceded authority to the states. In her dissent, Justice Kagan recommended a three-part test to determine whether redistricting was in fact partisan gerrymandering. Kagan said courts should first ask whether the mapmakers intended to entrench their party's power by diluting the votes of the opposing party. Second, by analyzing past maps, asking whether they succeeded. And third, comparing the contested map with maps using established fair criteria, asking mapmakers to defend their suspect maps. The New Mexico Supreme Court advised its lower court to employ this test to determine whether Democrats exceeded the reasonable amount of partisan gerrymandering as allowed in Article 2, Section 18 of the state constitution when redistricting the state's second congressional district. If adopted by other courts, it could help curb partisan gerrymandering where state constitutions forbid it. The district court trial begins September 27th. We have articles and court briefs at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Eric Losh. I live in Hudson. My wife and I have been here living in Hudson for a year now. New York City for 13 years, a little bit of other places in the Hudson Valley as well. And I'm a birder, and I'm a birder and an artist. And so my passion is kind of combining those two interests in a lot of the work I do. I do children's books. I do graphic design for different nonprofit organizations, logos or posters or just individual illustrations of animals and wildlife. And it's a lot of fun to be able to be an artist for some of these causes. I've basically been an avid wildlife lover since I was a kid. I consumed nature shows and encyclopedias and books about nature. You know, at a young age, I could tell you like all the offbeat animals from like kinkajous to cassowaries and all these like crazy things. My connection to birds was really inspired by my grandparents. I grew up in West Virginia, and we would take yearly vacations to the mountains in a place called Canaan Valley. My grandparents did volunteer bird banding at the Allegheny Front Migration Observatory, and that's in Dolly Sides, and that's another part of West Virginia, not far from Canaan. And they helped with autumn bird banding. And so visiting them once at the station, it was like my first time really seeing like a bird up close and in the hand. And it was a really cool experience. I mean, it was, I don't remember what birds they were, but I'm sure they were warblers, you know, like the really cool birds that as birders here in the Northeast, we're always excited about. And so that was a really nice, fun sort of introduction to birding. But, you know, I wasn't really a birder, so to speak, growing up. I mean, so I had this like just broad knowledge and interest in wildlife. But I think birding really took shape after I met my wife, Megan. As we were together, we started to do a little bit of traveling, a couple international destinations here and there, and, you know, nature-based experiences, but they weren't birding trips per se, but we would still record all of our sightings and be really interested in like, you know, the wildlife that was found in these certain parts of the world or certain places to be excited about. But I think it really, birding really stuck. It's because we were living in Brooklyn. I mean, that's where we met. And we were there for many, many years together. But, you know, we'd be sort of nature starved, right? Living and working in the big city, like, there's not, you wouldn't think that there would be a lot of opportunities for nature, but we didn't live very far from Prospect Park. And so we would go there often on the weekends and take the binoculars just for fun. And but then we really discovered that there was a lot to see, right? Like,
yes.
You would think it's a, like a, you know, such a well-trodden place. There's thousands of people there, but there's all these little nooks and crannies and places to explore. And we really started to have fun with it. You know, we would, you know, would slowly build up our knowledge about birds or bird songs or shapes of little tiny specks when they're far away in the tree and like trying to figure out what characteristics made those birds the, what they are. Birding also kind of marks time, especially in the Northeast, like with what season we're in and bird migration or in the spring or ducks in the winter and, you know, hawks in the fall, this sort of thing. And really, really kind of clicked. I mean, we kind of got even more into it. We would meet other birders and we would look at birding blogs. And of course I eventually discovered eBird. And so that really like that sort of citizen science aspect of like being able to record and track and see what other people were seeing and was exciting. Mm-hmm. So we found that little community and this like this interest together. And I think it was, you know, a great bonding experience for the two of us to be able to have an activity together, start from just an excitement for nature, but then like build that up and learn more and more and more together about the birds and our environment.
I want to ask you also to talk about yourself as an artist.
Yeah, and I would say that my interest in wildlife at a really young age was kind of like hand in hand with my interest in art. You know, I mentioned being inspired by the, you know, children's books that I would read and encyclopedias and then seeing the images of animals and then wanting to draw those. You know, I would do tracing and I would sketch them and just fascinated with all the different like shapes and sizes and varieties and colors of animals and different forms that they could take. And so I did a college program in West Virginia studying graphic design. And then I moved to New York City and I did a master's program. It was an MFA called Illustration as Visual Essay at the School of Visual Arts. And it was all about, you know, communicating and storytelling through your art. Mm. And so I wanted to be able to like kind of professionally get the opportunity and the skills to create similar types of art and graphics that inspired me when I was a kid and kind of like continue on with that tradition of image making and communicating about wildlife and science and things like that. And so I've been working full-time as a graphic designer. And as I mentioned, I take on a lot of freelance illustration work. And some of that is personal children's books that I've done, working for different conservation NGOs from like Global Wildlife Conservation, which is now Rewild, Rainforest Trust, the IUCN, and the Wildlife Conservation Society, to name a few. It's been some really exciting opportunities and feel really lucky to be able to use my skill set. Mm-hmm. For these missions.
And one of the things that's really great about your work, you know, the subject matter being very expressive and very communicative with the audience, even when it's one picture without no text accompanied, it really provokes the imagination. And like you've already discussed a little bit, you've worked with the organizations and groups in the United States and also internationally. And I imagine even when there's a language barrier or no matter what their age is, your audience must be able to feel related to your art easily. Could you maybe talk a little bit more about what role do you think your art has been able to play in nature conservation efforts using that power of communication?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about my children's books that I've done. You know, what I'm looking to do is create animal books that maybe, you know, like I said, I would have enjoyed as a kid. So like, thinking about what transfixes me, like these scenes, these illustrations of like a jungle or a forest and all these little intricate things happening there. It's the interactions between the animals. It's, you know, you mentioned certain characteristics that sort of draw viewers in. And I do try to like punch it up a little bit with color and, you know, a little bit maybe expressive eyes or getting a little bit of emotion out of the animal, because some of this work is geared just towards children, and that's kind of the media that they see in cartoons and comic books and their sort of children's resources. So, you know, it's, like I said, it's been my passion to use the illustration and design to tell stories. And, you know, I'm trying to connect like biology or zoology or wildlife conservation with the general public. And I think in a lot of ways, that's kind of its own language barrier, right? Whether it's not just linguistic, it's you're trying to be a bridge almost between what this conservation organization is trying to do out in the field first, like, and then relaying that to everyday people who might be able to support the organization and translate that through my art to make it engaging and captivating for people. So when I did my first children's book, The Chorus of Kibale, I did it with anthropomorphized characters so they could, you know, talk and interact. The main character was a red-tailed monkey, and she gets lost in the Kibale rainforest in Uganda. It was based off of a, inspired by a trip that I took to Uganda. So this monkey, she's a stand-in for the reader, right? She gets lost in the forest. She's trying to find her way back home. And so she's encountering all these new creatures, these new sights, these new sounds. And so she's almost, you know, she's experiencing some of those things for the first time, the same way that a viewer is opening, changing each page, going to a different location in the forest. And so there's, you know, there's all sorts of wildlife in there. And when we talk about birds, I'm trying to pack as much into these books. And I've got kingfishers and turricos, barbets, and primates in Kibale National Park are really abundant. And so there's everything from chimpanzees to bush babies. And so I'm really, you know, packing in as much like biology material into a kid's story, but having it, you know, feel a little bit rooted in real life or real life ecology. It was a personal project, but as I was finishing it, I partnered with some conservation organizations to help me promote the book because I did some personal fundraising to get it printed. So I worked with the Primate Education Network and then a Ugandan NGO called Unite for the Environment. And they work specifically around Kibale National Park, working with educational curriculums in schools to teach conservation. And so working with these organizations, we did get the books, we raised enough funds to get the books printed and sold. And then some of the proceeds generated enough money to reprint the books in the local language called Rutshuro. And that's the local language spoken around Kibale National Park in Uganda. And so I actually had those printed and I went back. I took another trip a few years later after the book was published and I got to like see kids interacting with the book and I saw it in the school classrooms and I've seen photos also of kids reading the book and it's really exciting to see them kind of flipping through and being excited about like their book representing their place.
You're listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM. My guest today is Eric Losch, a wildlife illustrator based in Hudson.
Kieran here with you. We're going to talk about the Hudson Eye Festival. We have, let's see, we got someone, oh, I'm going to put on my video. We got folks, hello there. Jean Blackbird on the line, Mimi Graminski, I think, with us. And hold on, there's another one. Well, hopefully Isaiah maybe and Jonah will be joining us as well. But I would like to introduce the Hudson Eye Festival. I'm just going to read from this little blurb I got here. It's Hudson Eye stimulates creativity, expands diversity, and grows tourism with a multi-venue series. Active since 2006, Jonah Beaucaire Arts Foundation presents the Hudson Eye, arranged by Ascendant Curatorial Voice, Aaron Levi Garvey. The Hudson Eye is an artist-driven 10-day annual public program and urban showcase focusing on dance, music, performance, film, visual art, dining out, nightlife, and hot topics panels, highlighting issues of interest to the local community. So this is taking place August 25th, which started last Friday already, through September 4th, which is next Monday. As a celebratory close to Hudson's peak tourism weekend of the summer, we work deeply at all levels of the city to consider what it means to be part of the Hudson community fabric and look inward at our relationship to the city of Hudson over the past 17 years of programs. The Hudson Eye was born to be shared annually in partnership and steers an anonymous $50,000 of local matching grant to Hudson to stimulate local giving. So there's from the website there. We got Jonah Beaucaire on the line right now. tuning in, connecting to the audio. So welcome, Gene, Mimi, Jonah, and I hope I'm saying the names right. I think I got Blackburn from Minsky, right? But there's Jonah right there. Is it Jonah Bocair? Welcome to the Monday afternoon show.
Thank you. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. It's hopefully a happy Monday for many people. And I am just absolutely thrilled and amazed at the extent and depth of this festival that I wasn't too aware of. I've been a little out of the Hudson Loop since moving out some while ago, but I have so many friends and love to visit there, and am so impressed about what's going on in the arts world, music world. You have dining out, visual art, nightlife, and Hot Topics panels. So, Jonah, do you want to take it away and introduce a little bit more? I just read off of the introduction there from
what you said. Sure. Kieran, it's a joy. Absolutely. Happy Monday, including to our listeners. I'd like to welcome Mimi Graminski, an artist who, let's go in reverse order. On Labor Day, the Spotlight Salon, Mimi Graminski at Window on Hudson. And just last night, Gene Blackburn, the renowned Gene Blackburn. So they are also on the Zoom, and we start by crediting them. Kieran, just to harmonize with you, the Hudson Eye is an annual arts festival that's now getting quite a bit of national attention. For us, though, this is all about artists and all about venues, I could say, as well. Thank you for bringing up that poster designed by Myron Polenberg. The website is very robust. So it's after about 17 years of local engagement that we're able to speak to you today, kind of on behalf of the arts. And we're working with 53 local entities. So we're very honored to do this work. And I'm joined by peer artists on the call too.
Absolutely fantastic. So can we just go through our guests again right now? We got Gene, yeah, Blackburn, and Mimi.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi there. We briefly spoke. We have someone on the way to Providence, Rhode Island, pulled over right now talking on this Monday afternoon show. So I love that. And can we hear a little bit about your participation in, maybe should we start with Gene up there? Let's just the top randomly.
Sure, well, yeah, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. And what a vibrant, wonderful community. I was in a show at the Turley Gallery on Green Street in Hudson. It was a two-person show, with an artist named Jay Stern, and another artist, Andy Slomenska, in the drawing room, it was a show that addressed the domestic setting in a variety of different ways through a variety of different lenses. So it was a real pleasure to be part of that show and deal with what I think is a really timely, powerful topic.
Domestic settings.
I'm sorry, what's that?
The powerful topic, domestic settings, you said?
The domestic. I think the domestic is such a... It's a place where we start. It's such a such an intimate setting. It's where we all learn so much about the world. But as we grow, I think our perceptions of it change. And I think our society is in a complicated place right now. So the domestic is, you know, it's a very fraught and interesting place to look at and examine. So it was really, I think, a powerful topic to be able to speak about and address in this talk last night. So that was a pleasure.
Gene, you spoke beautifully last night. Gene is making reference to the Turley Gallery program. Kieran, you're facilitating so well. The Hudson Eye really does 53 events or so. It's a 1 p.m. free daily humanities program with a strong focus on the arts, and as well as a 7:30 p.m. nightly show as well. In case I cut out there, We have our 1 p.m. talks and our 7:30 p.m. show, gallery, exhibitions constantly. And so Jean was showing at Turley Gallery alongside Andy Slamenda and Jay Stern. So Jean, you're just off of the heels of that program. And Mimi, if I'm not mistaken, is going to begin her install soon.
Yes, awesome. I'm going to be installing my work tomorrow. Starting tomorrow, it'll probably take me all week to install at Window on Hudson. The title of the exhibit is called Between Shadow and Light. And it's primarily textiles. There's going to be a lot of colors, a lot of movement, shadow. I'm really looking forward to installing at Window on Hudson. I showed there once before at the very beginning of COVID in 2020. And that was a bit of a difficult time to be showing work, but I'm really thrilled to be there again, to be working with Jonah and also the director of Window on Hudson, Jeremy Bullis. It's really a pleasure to be part of this wonderful festival that's really brought so much to Hudson, both the people who are seeing the different art venues for the first time and the people who live there and see them all the time. It's a real pleasure to be part of that.
And Mimi, this is, I love how you describe that. It's almost as an alum of Window on Hudson, run by Jeremy Bullis, and also I would nod to the curatorial force that puts this together, which is actually broadening right now. Mimi, this is kind of a victory lap for you, right, at that venue and with such an artisanal practice. I just love that we have both Jean and Mimi, you know, regional treasures truly and national treasures. I love that this is really how the participation came to be today. So
It's a real pleasure for me to be back at Window on Hudson. I have a very different exhibition than I did 3 years ago. But it's a pleasure for me in another way, Jonah and Kieran, in that I actually grew up in this area. I grew up in Columbia County on a farm and moved away and then came back. And it's been such a pleasure to see the arts so alive and so vibrant. So for me, I'm looking at it from a couple different points of view, both, you know, being an artist now here and then with memory of my childhood in the area. So it's kind of an interesting perspective.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, this theme, Kieran, you have a screen share here that says, you know, local artists and local venues, as well as our mission, basically. When supporting local artists and local venues, that's surprisingly full time. That's good. That's a good thing. But just the, some have called it a renaissance in this region, creatively speaking. So you know, it's quite full on, these 10 words that Kieran has on the screen, you know, the mission, basically. Kieran, I was wondering, have you attended an event? I know that we've been at it for a while, or is this sort of...
I've been away. I was up in the Boston area for some family stuff, and I'm over in Housatonic in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I moved here about 5 years ago. I've been very involved with Hudson over... See, I was demolishing and remodeling buildings since... the year 2000 in Hudson to prepare the spaces for all these wonderful activities that are now happening. And so Mimi, having grown up in the area, you probably remember when the only reason you ever went to Hudson was probably three reasons: Amtrak, the DMV, or Mama Rosa's Pizza.
Well, actually, I have to contradict that. I mean, I grew up going to all the stores on Warren Street, the shoe stores and Jupiter, Newberry,
Rogerson's. It's not
Rogerson's, McKinstry's. My father would go to the junkyard, which was on Columbia Street. I remember spending a lot of time there. And so, yeah, no, I spent a lot of time doing just the ordinary shopping that you do. You know, in a town, that was the town that we would come to do all our shopping. So yeah. Although the DMV was, and the courthouse and those things were all definitely part of it.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that the Catskill Planning Board is proposing banning residents from converting shipping containers into dwellings. Some people across the world have converted one or more shipping containers into housings, saving on lumber and other costs. Catskill Town Supervisor Dale Finch said, and I quote, "The proposed container law is a proactive approach to maintaining the aesthetics of the community and minimizing the negative effects they would have on a community. The proposed container law takes into consideration the different zoning districts, so different criteria will apply depending on the district," end quote. In 2021, Catskill had an incident with a shipping container when the village of Catskill filed a lawsuit against a Library Street resident with a container in his backyard that was larger than the village code allowed. Catskill Town Justice Richard Polino ruled for a bench trial or that the defendant could get the proper permits or remove the container altogether. But the judge was upset weeks later when Village of Catskill officials told the resident he could keep the container on his property throughout construction. Polino said, and I quote, "I'm kind of aggravated because the time wasted on this matter since June of this year, all of a sudden now, because somebody doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, they're going to change the law. But not really change the law, they're just going to cover up the violations," end quote. The story does not say when any vote on the matter is, nor mention any public hearing on the matter. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Mid-Hudson News reports that Columbia County had the lowest rate of unemployment in the Hudson Valley in the month of July, according to the Department of Labor. Columbia County's 2.6% unemployment rate was just lower than the 2.7% rate in Sullivan County. Columbia County's rate was down from 2.9% a year ago. Greene County was at 3.4%, down from 3.6% a year ago.